Would you give your mum, dad, aunt or that uncle who hugged your partner a little too long free access to your phone?
Oh, no!
Oh, my God, it's a really long video. Ew!
In Dave's brand new YouTube original, Get Off My Phone, we've got six comedians to give their phones over to a relative with total freedom to read messages, DMs, photos and browser history.
Where's your search history?
Sorry?
What to do, tips for relief.
The rules are simple. Their relative can read anything they want and even make calls from the comedian's phone.
What is this?
What is... I don't want this one.
That looks really bad.
Starring Tanya Moore, Anya Magliano, Finlay Christie, Travis J with his mum Angie Lamar, Hayley Morris, Grace Campbell and dad Alistair Campbell.
Slightly sexually compromising
people. Divulging their deepest digital secrets.
What the hell is happening?
Get Off My Phone, a Dave YouTube original. Available now on Dave's YouTube channel.
What ho, jolly podders. I'm Ben Shires, and you're whoever you are, and this is the Dave Weekly. Phew, and I always thought I was bad at introductions. Well, now we've got that out of the way, and we're all friends, let's move on to the small talk. I believe that's what you're supposed to do next. Okay, so, how are you? Oh, you don't say. But it'll clear up with the cream. Marvellous. And how are things going with that person you were seeing? Oh dear, well, don't do anything rash. Actually, that's a poor choice of words under the circumstances. Abort, abort. Right, well, it looks like I've well and truly dug myself into a conversational hole. Luckily, today's guests are more than adept at getting us out of it. First, we have the engaging, enlightening and surprisingly raunchy Giles Brandreth, who we met, where else, but in an upmarket London hotel, giving us a little insight into his very interesting life. And hot on his heels is the very excellent Holly Walsh, who turned up on a folding bicycle, although I should point out that it was unfolded when she rode it. What an age to live in. Well, listen, I'm delighted, if not a little in awe, to welcome to the show a writer, a broadcaster, former MP, government whip, founder of the award-winning Teddy Bear Museum, also a former European Monopoly champion and president of the British Scrabble Players. It's Giles Brandreth.
I'm very excited to be here. Big Bad Ben. I tune into the show on a regular basis. I never miss a Dave podcast, if I can help it, in the hope of hearing somebody going, Big Bag Ben, and they don't.
Well, I mean, you know, it has been noted. It's sadly lacking in all the prior podcasts to this one, Giles. But thankfully, we've got you along to redress the balance.
I'm here to redress, and I'm excited to be here. Now, what are we going to talk about?
Well, hopefully, a lot about you. Because as much as I enjoy talking about myself, and I sincerely do, as you can imagine, you've got such an astounding CV, a brilliant career to delve into.
I tell you, you find me here, Ben, in a state of a mixture of exhaustion and excitement. I've recently returned from Edinburgh.
Yes.
I was performing on the Edinburgh Fringe, and it's the fourth time I've been to Edinburgh. And Edinburgh really changed my life, because I used to be a Member of Parliament. Mm-hmm. I was a Member of Parliament until the people spoke. And in my case, they spoke in no uncertain terms. I mean, I knew I had contempt for my constituents, but it was a slight shock to the system to find the feeling was entirely mutual. And my wife said to me, look, Giles, when one door closes, it's shut. They don't want you anymore. They're not interested in you. They don't like you. You didn't just lose. It was catastrophic. It was a humiliation. Get on with doing something else. And I thought, what do I want to do? And I went to Edinburgh. I went to the Edinburgh Fringe, and I put on a show there. We did 100 musicals in 100 minutes. And it was huge fun. And a huge success. We won the, you know, best, most popular audience show. We did a tour, 60 places around the UK. We played in the West End. It was fabulous. Mm. And I loved Edinburgh because, of course, in Scotland, they don't have conservative MPs. They don't know what the idea is. They had no idea who I was. They just thought, here's this man, and he seems to be quite funny. So it was a big success. And the Edinburgh Fringe is a very forgiving, loving place. And you meet people of all ages, all types. And I loved it. And I went back a second time and did Shakespeare, Twelfth Night, a musical version. That was fun. Then I went back a third time and did stand-up. And that seemed to go quite well. And so this time they said to me, bring a new show. And I'd got interested in happiness.
Yeah, now I've read about this. This is quite interesting,
isn't it? It's very interesting. It's particularly interesting because I discovered, well, it's well known, that happy people will live 7 to 10 years longer than unhappy people.
Wow.
Yeah. So it makes it, so my show, if you come to see my show, Looking for Happiness, buy my book, The Seven Secrets of Happiness, you don't, it doesn't just enhance your life, it extends your life.
Incredible. And I imagine by people coming to your show, buying your book, makes you happier. So it's extending your life as well. I mean,
it's happiness all round, I can tell you.
There's oodles of it. Seemingly.
And it came about because 15 years ago, when I lost my seat, you know, when the people spoke.
So this was when the Labour landslide happened in
1997. Labour landslide. In comes Tony Blair, full of hope. He was quite pale in those days. He's just become this funny orange colour in more recent years. He's now the sort of Dale Winton of the international peace process. Nice guy, though, and a lovely wife, too. I like Cherie. No, a genuine news, just doesn't take a very good photograph. Anyway, a good woman, a nice power... If you're into power couples, they are good people.
On the top Trump scale,
they are.
Yeah.
Emphasis on the Trump. Anyway, he sweeps in, I'm swept out. What do? And I do feel, they say you shouldn't take it personally, but I did take it personally. I mean, I was a conservative. I was a loyal conservative, though. You know, when John Major became the leader of my party, I began to go grey. Instinctive, visceral loyalty. You know, when William Hague became the leader of my party, that's when I began to go bald. I just do it.
I thought you were going to say, and when Anne Widdecombe joined, that's when I became the virgin again.
It suddenly occurred to me, anything could have happened.
Yeah.
And indeed, when they started the coalition, you know, the two lovely posh boys, Nick and Dave, getting it together, both over 6 foot tall, glossy hair, rather attractive in their own way. That's when I thought, well, maybe I can come out as a little bit gay. So, I lose my seat in 1997. I've got to do other things. I go to Edinburgh. I get onto the fringe. The people there are friendly. I do these shows. And this year, I like to do different things each time.
Mm.
And I thought, I'll do a show about happiness because, having lost my seat, I did find it hurtful. And at the same time, it coincided with the death of my best friend who'd been at school with me. And then my brother died, my sister died, my father died, not so surprisingly, he was much older. And I thought, oh God, it's all a bit grim. But I was the fellow in the funny jumpers, Mr. Being Jolly. This isn't right. You should be happy. You've got everything in the world. You've got a lovely wife, wonderful children, good job. You've got to get to grips with yourself. And I'd read somewhere that Sigmund Freud, you know what I mean by Freud, the great Dr. Freud, had said that to be happy, you need to love and to work. And I thought, well, I've got friends and family to love, and I've got interesting work to do. And then suddenly, of course, I lost my job. I wasn't an MP anymore. And friends and family, they were literally dying around me. And I thought, actually, Freud, you haven't got it quite right, because to love and to work, it's easy to say. It sounds good, something for the fridge door. To love and to work makes you happy. But actually, you can lose your job. Love, it can all go wrong. I need something that actually is more sustaining than that. And I thought, I'm going to find out how to be happy. Freud, I had his name in my address book. I looked, phoned up, it turned out to be Clement Freud. Very different thing, grandson of Dr. Freud.
Maybe some of it's rubbed off.
But it hadn't. I was listening to the radio, and on the radio, on the wireless, on a Sunday morning, I heard this voice, an Irish lilting voice, a psychiatrist called Professor Anthony Clare. And this man presented a programme on BBC Radio 4 called In the Psychiatrist's Chair. And he had different famous people come and chat to him. And it was a marvellous programme. And he did it for several years. And he was clearly a very wise dude. So I got hold of him. I made an appointment. I flew to Dublin and met Professor Anthony Clare. And I said to him, I'm looking for the seven secrets of happiness. And he smiled. Yeah.
Hang on a second. You came there. It sounds like you're on some kind of Indiana Jones quest. You were looking for the seven secrets.
I was.
Did you know there were seven? Did he tell you?
He did laugh at that. He said, seven. Are there seven of them?
Yeah. And you've got eight. I'm not interested. Stop at seven.
I said, well, it's a sort of magic number. And he said, let's see if we can find the seven. And we began chatting. We began talking about my parents. And I asked him, I said, why do my parents, people of my parents' generation, my father was in the Second World War, fought in the Second World War, you know, risked his life. My mother was in London during the Second World War, bombs falling in London. I said, why do they talk about the Second World War as the happiest time of their lives? And many people of my parents' generation, your grandparents' generation, say, oh, the war was the best time of our life. Why is that? And he said, well, that's quite easy to explain. During the Second World War, the people at home, they felt united. There was a common purpose. There was a country that actually agreed about one thing. There was this sense of unity and common purpose, and that made them feel happy. And the people at the front, the guys, it was mostly blokes, in the army, the air force, the navy, they were risking their lives, but they were being tested. He said, and all the research shows that being tested is an important element of being happy. He said, you'll very rarely find happy people sitting around doing nothing. They've got to be engaged with life. And I thought, this man is intriguing. Mm. So from this basis, we began exploring and trying to discover what those seven secrets were. And I've now turned it into a show. One of the rules is...
Come see the show.
Well, no, it isn't. You don't need to see the show. You can just buy the book. But if you don't come to see the show, it is quite fun, actually. One of the rules is to not resist change.
Right. Loose change? Or now, are we talking wide-ranging?
We're talking change in your life. And so people might think, oh, God, I'm going to see him. Go on, do it. Because I find change very difficult. Mm. I mean, I do not want to learn another frigging password. I can tell you that much. And I was in Sainsbury's local this morning. I put down my bag and suddenly I heard this voice speaking at me, you know, unidentified object on bagging area. F off. You know, I'm not interested. I find change very difficult, but you should take change on board.
Mm. Although difficult to have a conversation with that machine, I found.
But quite fun. Actually... quite fun.
They're very self-obsessed.
They're self-obsessed. They're unhappy, and they're not interested in you either. Yeah. They really aren't.
In fact, that woman sounds very tetchy. You know, I think she's got bigger issues than unidentified objects in her bagging area.
She has. And actually, she's now suffering from abuse because I kicked her.
Yeah. So, listen, you've done so much in your career, Giles, and I really want to talk about some other stuff.
Yeah, of course.
You were part of the pornography inquiry with Lord Longford.
I was. That's a long time ago.
I heard a Radio 4 documentary on this about 3 or 4 years ago. I listened with acute interest because this was in the 70s when you got the likes of Mary Whitehouse doing her moral crusades against moral indecency on television, in the press. And so what was your role? I mean, what did you actually do? Because didn't you have to go to Denmark and visit sex clubs?
It was amazing.
It sounds like a very in-depth inquiry.
I was just down from Oxford University, and Lord Longford, people may not know who he is, and in Lamoy, he died a few years ago, well into his 90s. He was a great guy in many ways. He was a Catholic convert. He'd been a minister in Harold Wilson's government. He was a prison visitor, prison reformer, a bit of a frost at parties, to be honest, chiefly because he liked to bring Myra Hindley with him. Anyway, but he was a good man, and he launched this crusade against the scourge of pornography in our society. Mm. And he wanted some younger people on his committee, because he had a lot of old folk, and he wanted some younger people. So he asked me, and wait for it, Cliff Richard. And we were the two young guys, and Cliff was gorgeous, or he still is, because of all that oil of ole. But, I mean, Cliff was gorgeous, and he turned up in these lovely little velvet trousers and little lovely shirts with frills on, and I really took to Cliff in a big way. That was one of the upsides of being on the pornography committee. And I really was. I
mean, the upside was Cliff Richard.
Well, a bit of a bonus on a regular basis, going to meetings with Cliff Richard. You know, he was in his 20s then. He was an attractive boy.
I see.
And he could sing and he looked good.
what was Cliff Richard's view on pornography?
He was against it.
Was he?
He was against it. Well, he was
brushed up against it?
He wasn't brushed up against it. He was against it for the reason that people... what is interesting is that a lot of things that Lord Longford was mocked about, we actually would now agree with. And I did join this pornography committee, and we did go to these sex clubs. I mean, I've still got the raincoat I bought at the time.
And what purpose did the raincoat have in these sex clubs?
Because everyone wore a raincoat to a sex club. It was obligatory to wear a raincoat. My wife sewn up the pockets now, but I've still got it. It's down there in the cloakroom.
There'll be more smiles with Giles in a bit, but first up, it's time for some Jolly with Holly. Walsh, that is. Holly Walsh, welcome to the Dave Weekly.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing?
Very hot.
Yeah,
hot
well...
hot and sweaty.
That's how you like to arrive, right?
This is how I feel
Holly
when
Walsh
I'm doing a podcast.
Holly Walsh has come and she is hot.
Yeah, that's me.
Is partially the reason you're hot because you're the first comedian I've known to arrive at the Dave Weekly on their own folding bicycle.
Yes, that's me. I came on my bike... and I misinterpreted the weather somewhat, and I am now a sweaty mess. So I apologise for that. I'm just glad no one can smell me on this podcast.
Well, you say that, but...
That's why you're sitting 18 foot away from me.
You
right
have
now.
Stink lines. I've never seen that on a person before. I just thought they were reserved for the Beano.
It's awful, yeah.
No, actually, you're only radiating loveliness. You don't look sweaty at all. Do you know, it's like one of those things where you think you're so much harsher on yourself
than other people would be. I think you've got to have a very distinct personal musk in order for that to be detected.
Everybody has a personal musk.
They do, but you have to get usually quite close in order to smell that.
I don't know. I've seen a few, mainly gentlemen, on the tube or bus,
right,
who've had a very distinct musk from 15 or 20 foot away from me. You know that.
I thought you were going to talk about ages then and the different ways that developed within young gentlemen.
No, just
I thought you're a real musk connoisseur for a minute.
I've been up close to a lot of men's armpits, just because I am the height of most men's armpits. So on any kind of public transport, I tend to be eye level with a gland.
Yeah.
Or sitting down, same principle.
Exactly. I mean, it's good to know where you stand on those issues as well.
Well, I know where I stand, and I stand in the gland.
Yeah, exactly. In the gland stand.
Yeah.
So let's talk about something away from life standard, which obviously you're doing a lot of at the moment,
aren't
you?
Yeah, I've kind of gone back to it a bit, which is quite exciting.
But you've done all sorts as well. I mean, you've done TV presenting. I went to see you, actually, when you did TNT.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a while ago now, you and
that
Jack
That was ages ago, yeah. Me and Jack did a show for Channel 4, which was on very late.
About four or five years ago, something like that.
In the
summer.
Weird.
I remember queuing in an extremely long queue and just making the cut-off point for it, which was quite exciting at the time. And
is that just to touch Jack Whitehall? Is that key for?
No. I mean, I have obviously, always longed to touch him and his little beard.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to see telly being made. I mean, this was at a point before I was, working in the industry, and I think there's just a rush from actually seeing things happen, which I imagine is the same sort of rush that you got last year when you got a sitcom commissioned and made.
Yeah, I've been very, very lucky in so far as I've sort of done a lot of different things within comedy. And I think probably I'm a jack of all trades a bit, but I really like the fact that you can think of a joke and it doesn't have to go into stand up, or it doesn't have to go like you could think of a joke and you're like, that's funny, that would work really well as a sketch or as a scene or as a, bit of stand up or whatever. And having that kind of choice is quite exciting. Also, there's jokes I could never do, but I could write a character who could do those jokes, and that's kind of fun. And that's why you just have to do hundreds of rewrites. It's all about rewriting.
So, I mean, we skirted around it, but this was Dead Boss, by the way, that you were...
Yeah, that's the show I did with Sharon Horgan.
Yeah, and you've been writing that with her for ages, because I read an interview when you were calling it Bitches.
Bitches, yeah. It went through so many titles. It was called Bitches for ages. And then it was called My So-Called Life Sentence for a long time.
That's good.
And then it got to Dead Boss. So it really did have a lot of
And it
titles.
Didn't get commissioned when it was called Bitches. I mean, now you're back doing the stand-up, but do you think there can be sort of running in parallel, sort of the sitcom side of things and the stand-up?
Well, that's sort of what I've been doing this year, and it's kind of fun, but it is a double life. You do feel like by day I kind of do an office job. I sit down with the computer and write, and by night I'm standing in front of groups of people, talking about fingering clowns. Let's go with clowns this time.
Yeah,
but, you know,
why not?
Like, I think it is a double life, and I kind of think you have to do one or the other. You can do both for a bit, but not all the time. You have to sort of dip in and out. But this year, I think I really want to plow on with stand up. That's what I'm kind of enjoying at the moment and stuff.
What I was wondering is, what's the most nerve wracking thing to read? Is it the review of your stand-up show or the review of your sitcom?
I think the stand-up. I'd take it more personally.
Mm.
Because stand-up is just me on stage, and it's me saying my jokes that I wrote. So if people hate them or hate me, or there's just so many things to hate about it that are personal to me.
Yeah.
Whereas in a show, I could write something, and the fact that the actress is a trillion times is just brilliant. You know, she could deliver the joke and get a laugh from it because she just sold the joke so brilliantly and improve on it and things. I just think it's a collaborative thing, and there's so many variables in a TV show that could go right or wrong that you kind of have to be I don't know. I just definitely don't get quite. I mean, I really want it to be great and I really want to be proud of it, but I find reviews for stand-ups just that bit more personal.
It's been lovely speaking to you.
Thank you so
much.
Thanks
for dropping by. And where can people see you and doing your many gigs?
Well, I have a club that runs every other week in New Cross in South London. And it starts on Monday. We've got Stuart Lee, but it's every other Monday, and it's called Happy Mondays, and you can find it at happymondayscomedy.co.uk, I think. But you Google it.
Yeah, exactly. Google's there for a reason, so we don't have to remember detail.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks for coming in, and I'll hopefully pop by myself, because it sounds great.
Thank you.
Bye.
Great.
Right, that's it for Miss Walsh. Now it's back to Mr. Brandreth.
As I say, Giles, there's so much that I would like to talk to you about. One of the things is your career as an author. Now, you've got your Oscar Wilde series of books, which I've had the pleasure, the distinct pleasure, of reading some, and I think they're absolutely excellent. But for the reason, not only that they're well written, but I think they're quite brave in that you take on two giants of the literary world, Oscar Wilde, Arthur Conan Doyle, and write them about them in a fictional way. And you have to voice these characters who are so famous for having their own voice, for being able to articulate themselves in the most resounding and loved ways. That must have been some undertaking.
Well, I discovered by chance that Oscar Wilde and Arthur Conan Doyle had met and had become friends.
Mm. At the Langham Hotel, if I'm quite a Doyle fan myself and dabble in Wilde.
Indeed, that plaque, there's a plaque outside the Langham Hotel.
Yeah, you can still go to it on the Strand if you're ever there.
Yeah,
and then both met to discuss what turned out to be critical novels.
I unveiled that plaque, you know.
Did you?
It was my idea to have that plaque.
That is so cool.
Because when I was an MP, I used to unveil plaques on a regular basis. Until I got to a doctor's surgery in my constituency, I pulled the little string and the velveteen curtains parted, and then I read the words on the plaque that I'd unveiled. It said, "This plague has been unveiled by Giles Brandreth, MP." So I gave up. But the last plaque I did was the one commemorating the meeting in 1889 between Oscar Wilde, Arthur Conan Doyle, invited by an American publisher to meet to talk about writing novels.
Mm.
And the result of this meeting was that Conan Doyle was persuaded to write the second Sherlock Holmes story.
The Sign of the Four.
Yeah, he might never have written another Sherlock Holmes story. And Oscar Wilde wrote what became The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Yeah.
And so I thought these two people, they obviously got on well together.
Mm.
Because Conan Doyle said about that evening it was a golden evening. And that Wilde completely...
Well, he was just a struggling surgeon. He was a nobody who couldn't get patients on Harley Street, who was kind of dabbling in writing.
Well, he didn't even get to Harley Street. He was down, in...
I was in Southend.
Yeah, South Sea.
South Sea, so... Yeah.
And indeed, a GP with not much of a practice. And so it transformed his life. And they became friends. And so I have them in my stories, like, in a sense, being Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Mm. They are my Holmes and Watson, and they get involved in different murder mysteries. And there's that whole amazing world of those guys. Bram Stoker, the same period.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
There's a dinner that I came across where six guys are having dinner. One of them is Arthur Conan Doyle, creates Sherlock Holmes. One of them is Oscar Wilde, created, The Picture in the Attic. One of them is Bram Stoker, who created Dracula, who was there because he was the... manager for
theatre manager, wasn't it? Henry Irving.
For Henry Irving.
Absolutely.
And Arthur Conan Doyle wanted Henry Irving to play Conan Doyle, play Sherlock Holmes.
Did he ever play him, by
the
way?
No, he didn't. He didn't want to do it. He played in another play by Arthur Conan Doyle.
Mm.
Conan Doyle's brother-in-law was there, who invented Raffles the Gentleman Cracksman.
Ah, of course, yeah.
Also at this dinner was Robert Louis Stevenson, who created Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
And the sixth person at the same meal, these are the six guys sitting together, was J.M. Barrie, who went on to create Peter Pan.
Incredible.
What was there in the fog of London in the 1880s, 1890s, that made these guys create these mythic characters that live with us, The British love a murder mystery.
Mm.
People love a murder mystery. Those sort of books that you want to read in a cold winter's night.
And there's something about that era as well, the 1880s, 1890s. It's Jack the Ripper. It's the kind of the height of the British Empire, the height of pomp, the height of sort of aristocracy and the upper classes, and yet this kind of, simmering underworld in London as well.
And also, as Oscar said, there's nothing quite like an unexpected death for lifting the spirits.
Or an unexpected séance.
One shouldn't laugh, but I knew... Rod Hull. Do you remember Rod Hull and
Emu? I do, of Emu fame, yes.
And Rod Hull, I don't know why I'm saying this, actually. I saw Rod Hull right at the end of his life with a friend of mine. They went to the theatre together. It was a snowy night, and Rod was complaining to the friend of mine about his TV aerial.
Oh, no.
And my friend said, "Get up on the roof tonight." And they'd had a bevy or two. Rod went back, got up onto the roof that very night, to fix his TV aerial fell off and killed himself.
You killed Rod Hull?
Well, my friend did. I won't name him because...
because otherwise the police will be interested.
Well, Emu might sue. And one shouldn't laugh, but there is a famous Chinese saying, there is no pleasure so great as watching a good friend fall off the roof. And there is something. I mean, I like going to...
Oh, those Chinese, they know their stuff, yeah, don't they?
I mean, I like going to a memorial. I've reached the age now. A lot of my friends are dead.
And it's a great day out, a funeral, isn't it?
Well, in a way it is, you know. And I often do the address and I look out at this and I think, well, I'm still here just and they're not. And that's sort of, that's something, isn't it?
I heard that you described Nicholas Parsons as on day release from heaven.
Ah, well, that's a rather good line, isn't it? I hope I did say that.
Yeah, that's a fitting of Wilde himself.
He's going to be with us for a little while longer. I went to one of his Bunga Bunga parties last week. There is snap in his celery, I can tell you.
Oh, there there is.
Nicholas Parsons, 90 this year. Isn't that marvellous?
Yeah, I heard he takes more than just a minute as well. He's,
indeed, he can sustain it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Deviation, plenty of that. Yeah. But very little
hesitation.
No hesitation. Good man, though.
Yeah. I mean, the fact is, you've got so much going on, Giles, plus you've got this formula for happiness. Are you going to be the longest living man ever?
Well, I don't know. The Queen Mother, who died aged 102, she used to say that to be happy, all one needs in life to be happy is to be content with what one has got.
So gin, then?
Which, possibly, gin and Giovanni in her case. if you're the Queen Mother, what you've got probably is enough to be happy with. So I don't know how long I will live, but I'm enjoying living by the day, by the hour, by the minute.
Listen, I think that's a great way to end it, Giles. Thank you for being educational, inspirational, and downright hilarious.
You are brilliant. I love your podcast. I love Dave. I love everything. Come and see the show.
Yes.
You can come, because where are you based?
London.
Oh, London. Well, come to the one in Richmond. We're doing Richmond. We're doing Epsom. I'm going to something, I think, called the Bruce Forsyth Auditorium in Edmonton.
Is that in Bruce Forsyth?
No, I think it's in Bob Hope. Oh, I think the theatre is called Bob Hope. And inside, I'm in the Bruce Forsyth... Anyway, it's somewhere in Edmonton. And I'm going to 60 different venues, and then I'm ending up in Leicester Square.
Oh, incredible.
I should have thought about that. I'm ending up at the Leicester Square Theatre at the end of next April.
We can debate what the statue is.
We can debate what the... Come to see the show.
And all the dates are on your website.
And all the dates are on my website, and I think you're brilliant.
Thank you, Giles.
It's
Thank
been
you
very,
very much.
A very exciting experience.
Well, that's it for today's lovely little show, and I'm sad to say it was also our penultimate, meaning that next week is the last of the series. Don't fret, though. Well, obviously, do fret a little. It's all part of the grieving process. But also, don't fret, because we've got a fantastic lineup to look forward to, including the French raconteur and pomme de terre Marcel Leconte, and one of my favourites, and the Dave Weekly's absolute gems, Greg Davis, making a triumphant return. In the meantime, check out our extensive back catalogue on iTunes and tweet hello or whatever else pops into your head. It doesn't matter. To the show at @join_Dave and me at @benshires. Till then, doodles doodles. The Dave Weekly is a Pixiu production for Dave, hosted by me, Ben Shires, and produced by Joel Porter.
Would you give your mum, dad, aunt, or that uncle who hugged your partner a little too long free access to your phone?
Oh, no! Oh, my God, it's a really long video. Ew!
In Dave's brand new YouTube original, Get Off My Phone, we've got 6 comedians to give their phones over to a relative with total freedom to read messages, DMs, photos, and browser history.
Where's your search history?
Sorry?
What to do, tips for relief.
The rules are simple. Their relative can read anything they want and even make calls from the comedian's phone.
What is this? What is...
I don't want this one.
That looks really bad.
Starring Tanya Moore, Anya Magliano, Finlay Christie, Travis J with his mum Angie Lamar, Hayley Morris, Grace Campbell and dad Alistair Campbell.
Slightly sexually compromising people.
Divulging their deepest digital secrets.
What the hell is happening?
Get Off My Phone, a Dave YouTube original. Available now on Dave's YouTube channel.